For Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week, we'll hear from television creator Alec Berg. Berg's television credits include writing and executive producing Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Silicon Valley, which is currently in its fifth season.
Silicon Valley is very much about awkwardness and stiffness and the comedy of the pause and, you know, strange looks to people, and it's more tonal. And this is just, I think, the next step in that progression.
Later, screenwriters that have successfully adapted books and other works for the big and small screen will discuss the challenges of capturing the spirit of the source material.
It's super helpful on many levels to come at it from a place of reverence for the creator. If you feel like you're on the side of justice and you're doing a good thing.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Alec Berg has written for some of television's most acclaimed comedies, including Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Silicon Valley. He co-created the new HBO show Barry with former SNL star Bill Hader. The series follows Barry, played by Hader, who is a depressed, low-level hitman looking for a way out. I recently spoke with Berg over the phone to discuss using research to help develop a story, avoiding cliches, and the evolution of a television comedy. Clips from Barry, courtesy of HBO.
Silicon Valley is coming back in March, and I'm also doing another show that I wrote and produced with Bill Hader called Barry, which is about a sort of low-rent Midwestern hitman who comes out to L.A. on a job and discovers a love for theater. So it's sort of set in the low-rent theater scene in Los Angeles.
I read a little bit about you guys having done some research in that world. Did you have a background as an actor before you got into writing, or?
I'm not qualified really to do anything except the writing side of it. I every time I walk in front of a camera, I get nervous, so I stand behind them. But, you know, obviously Bill has been acting for years. And, yeah, we did a bunch of research. We went to a bunch of acting classes and stuff out here when we were kind of putting the show together, which are fascinating and sort of enervating and slightly desperate and everything in between. It was really interesting to watch that process.
Well, how did you and Bill Hader get connected? And then ultimately, this idea, how did it come to pass between the two of you?
Well, Bill and I have kind of known each other just sort of through comedy circles for years, and we have the same agent. And when Bill was kind of getting off of Saturday Night Live and looking for the next thing, he started thinking about what he wanted to do, and he made a deal with HBO. And I've been working at HBO for years, so we were both kind of at the same company, and we knew each other, and we had similar interests. And Bill had done a movie with Larry David that I co-wrote called Clear History that was on HBO. So we kind of had that connection, and we had been sort of talking while that was going on. And so we kind of liked each other, and we had similar tastes, and we liked the same things, and we hated the same things. So we just started talking, and, you know, we started having breakfast every week or every other week, just kind of knocking ideas around. And we went pretty far down the road with another idea until we realized that it was terrible. And then Bill one day just said, you know, we had kind of been talking about a very interesting thing that happened to Bill, which is that he is spectacularly gifted at improv comedy, but he doesn't really love it. It's not a passion of his, and he enjoyed Saturday Night Live, but it scared the bejesus out of him, and he spent 8 years, you know, kind of digesting his own stomach because he was so nervous on live TV. But he was kind of a prisoner of his gift in a weird way, because he was so good at it that obviously he couldn't walk away from it. And that idea of somebody who has a talent that they feel slightly obligated to and they don't really love it was an interesting idea that we kind of knocked around. And then one day he was like, what if I were a hitman and I were really good at that, but I hated it? And we sort of joke now that my immediate reaction was, ugh, hitman. you know, you say that word and it just has, there's such a cliched sort of idea around that. So I said the problem with the hitman is it's just too hitman. But then we started talking about this idea of, well, what if we could use those tropes and the cliches in a helpful way, in that you've kind of seen the kind of cool guy with the sunglasses and the skinny tie firing guns in slow motion. What if we portrayed it as just sort of a dead-end sales kind of job where he essentially is like a traveling salesman who hates his job and it just happens to be contract killing? And then once we kind of came around to that, it became, okay, well, that's what he hates. What does he want to do instead? And then I don't remember even how it came up, but just the idea that this guy decides that he wants to be an actor, you know, even though he has absolutely none of the skills required to do that, just because he's enamored with it, it started to sort of take an interesting shape. And we started thinking of all these kind of interesting contrasts where to be a killer, you kind of have to live in the shadows and you have to be anonymous. And to be an actor, you have to live in the light. And, you know, ideally, in success, you become a household name. And the two worlds were so opposite and sort of required completely opposite things that it was going to be pretty quickly apparent where all the clashes and the contrasts were, and how somebody who was trying to stay alive and continue to work as a killer couldn't also try and pursue a life as an actor.
Well, it's funny that you're talking about, you know, your first reaction and feeling like it was a cliche, because when I was watching it, that first moment of, oh, a hitman hits you, but it's so fresh and funny and super dark.
I think we were kind of trying to portray it as like the grimmest of dead-end jobs, and there's nothing fun or cool about it. And, you know, we kind of approached all the violence in the show the same way, where it was like we almost talked about it like we want it to feel like security camera video, where it's just, there's nothing glamorous or cool about it. It's just kind of dark and scary and kind of sad.
Yeah, that's how, I mean, the cast is really great, I guess, actually, is the thing that struck me. I mean, Stephen Root and Henry Winkler and Sarah Goldberg, who just is amazing.
Well, that was a very interesting sort of real thing we saw in an acting class. Bill and I went to visit one acting class, and the guy teaching it brought a woman up on stage and essentially kind of tore her apart. And I guess the exercise was sort of a form of humiliation on purpose, where he was making her sort of sing and jump up and down and run around. And the idea of the exercise, I guess, was to strip away all of her embarrassment and all of her sort of self-consciousness by making her do all these incredibly embarrassing things. And she actually ended up sobbing during the exercise. And at the end, she started thanking the teacher for giving her this gift of this level of clarity or whatever it was. And we just thought it was fascinating, because it really was almost Stockholm syndrome, where they were thanking their captors for beating them up. And when we had originally written the Gene Cousineau part, it was a much heavier, darker, sort of sadistic part. And then when we saw Henry Winkler doing it, he has such a natural warmth and a lightness to him that the character suddenly became a much more three-dimensional, interesting character, because instead of just being this brute, you know, there was a sort of an internal reasoning behind why this character would behave this way. And you see that he's really sort of wanting in life, and he just wants to be a successful actor also. And it's not happening for him out there, so that when he comes into this little world, he's kind of a king in this little fiefdom.
Even your excuses are false. You're up there, you're stinking up my stage, babe. What the f*** do you want?
The prescription.
Not Linda. You. Little Sally Reed from Joplin, Missouri. What do you want?
To be an actress?
Again, I don't believe you.
It's all I ever wanted in the whole world.
Oh, really? Except you don't think you're going to make it, do you? I mean, that's what you told me.
Oh, yeah. Last week, she takes me out for a cup of coffee after class, starts to cry, snot running down her nose. All of a sudden, she said, I'm not going to make it. I'm telling you, I was embarrassed. It was pathetic. Here is a person who's spending her money. She doesn't have any talent whatsoever. This chick shouldn't even be in this class. I cannot believe...
That is not fair, Gene!
Don't think. Just finish the scene.
Having an actor who can give you that depth and that contrast just made it just informed the character in a way, and we started writing him very differently. And I think it gave a real kind of like comedic spin to the character and a warmth and lightness to that it really needed, because the show has plenty of heaviness, but those moments of kind of silliness and levity are important to balance that out.
So can you talk a little bit about how your background with Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm and Silicon Valley? I mean, these are comedies, and this is a riding the line. It's very funny and, you know, as we said, very dark, too. And how did this background prep you for that or not? Was it difficult kind of moving into a genre that's not as predictably humorous?
I mean, I think it's definitely a natural sort of progression as I get older and as I've done more and more. You know, Seinfeld was an audience show. And sort of by definition, when you do an audience show, the sets aren't quite realistic because they have to be proscenium style, you know, and you have to shoot with four cameras. So the angles are very limiting. And the way you can block a scene is limited by how you have to shoot it. And there's also an interesting thing with the writing of an audience show where there's a rhythm that you kind of lapse into, where it has to be kind of set up joke, because you've got an audience there and they need to be laughing. And if they're not laughing, it's very quiet. And there's nothing louder than the silence of 280 people not laughing at something. But it dictates the scope of what you can do. And on Silicon Valley, you know, and Curb to a lesser extent. Curb was a restrictive form because it's a fake documentary. So you couldn't get very cinematic. Anytime we would try and do any sort of camera move or anything slightly composed or conceptual, you'd get into the edit on Curb, and those things would just feel wrong because it has to feel like a documentary. So everything was kind of handheld, and it felt like it was sort of found in the moment. So you couldn't really do anything stylistic or cinematic. And then Silicon Valley, I think, that got a little bit, just in the progression of what I've worked on, was a little bit more cinematic, and we started doing a lot more stuff. Silicon Valley is very much about awkwardness and stiffness and the comedy of the pause and, you know, strange looks to people, and it's more tonal. And this is just, I think, the next, you know, at the risk of sounding impossibly pretentious, this is kind of just the next step in that progression, where Bill is a real film buff. He's a real cinephile. And we talked a lot about movies and what feel we should be going for. And he spent a lot of time on the episodes he directed talking to our cinematographer about, you know, oh, this should feel like the shot in this movie or that movie. So it's just a natural progression, I think.
And he's directing these two, right, Bill?
He directed the pilot and the first two episodes after that. So the first three are his. And then I ended up directing the last two of this first run.
You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Barry co-creator Alec Berg. Berg's writing has been nominated for 14 Emmy Awards, 6 WGA Awards, a Golden Globe, and a Razzie. When we left off, Berg was discussing the importance of balancing tone. So you were talking about this being new ground, and especially for him. I mean, it's new ground for both of you, obviously. But one thing I think that struck me was I'm so used to seeing him be so kinetic and energetic and
Here, he's a very different character. And you were talking about him not really loving the improv as much as... is this something that he was really wanting to get into, where he was carrying his own show?
It's less about the acting for him than it is about, oddly, about the writing. And the funniest thing is, as a writer, and he'll tell you this, his biggest sort of weakness as a writer is writing for himself. That we did an internal table read where we just had some friends come and read the parts early on in the pilot process. And we read the script, and we were very happy with how it was playing. But the one big takeaway is Bill wasn't really in the show, you know, and Bill had spent all of his time and energy really focusing on all these other characters. And we realized, like, okay, now we have to figure out a way to build up Bill's part. And it's tricky, especially season one, because the arc of his character in season one is he goes from this kind of very stilted, disconnected guy who's kind of in this emotional deep freeze to becoming more in touch with his emotions and realizing that, you know, he needs to nurture that part of his life. But it's a very tricky part to play, because playing the lack of emotion and the lack of sensitivity, the tendency is to just play kind of, you know, dead. And that's not very fun to watch. And it's not, I would imagine, very fun to play, just a guy who's sort of sullen. So that was a big challenge, writing and I'm sure acting-wise, is just how do you put some energy and some life into a guy who's supposed to be emotionally dead inside?
So two shows at one time on HBO, that's pretty great. You must be incredibly busy.
It's great to have done it. They both shows, Silicon Valley and Barry, air starting March 25th. Silicon Valley's on at 10 and Barry's on at 10:30. Because of the way their HBO schedule works, we've been done with Barry, completely done, like the final episode wrapped and put away for almost 5 months. You know, it's such a weird part of doing TV that you're incredibly in control and involved in every bit of the process, from conception to casting to shooting to editing to color timing and sound mix. And then the one part of the process that's really the most important part, which is the show going out to an audience, you have almost no participation in. You know, it's like you just do the show and you throw it in a hole, and then every once in a while somebody will come up to you and say they saw it. But you don't have any participation in that part. So it's great to just think about the fact that, oh, this thing that we did that has been sitting on a shelf is finally going to get out into the world.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Next, we'll hear from three screenwriters who have tackled the difficult task of adaptation. Sarah Gubbins co-created the Amazon series I Love Dick, which was based on the 1997 novel of the same name. Mark Hames wrote the 2016 animated film Kubo and the Two Strings, and is currently working on adapting the graphic novel Nimona and the best-selling novel The Girl Who Drank the Moon. Eric Heiserer adapted the novella The Story of Your Life into the 2016 Oscar-nominated film Arrival. Gubbins, Hames, and Heiserer spoke with me at the 24th Austin Film Festival to discuss translating themes and literary devices, collaborating with authors, and when to take creative liberties.
First of all, the industry seems anymore not to care about anything that's not IP in some form or fashion. And so what's the attachment you have to the piece to inform whether you even want to take this as an adaptation, and if you do, how you approach it?
You know, if I'm really connected to a piece of source material, a short story or a novel or something like that, I do a little tiny book report just for me. And the first page is, how does this make me feel? And I just describe whatever rainbow of feelings that I got from the experience of that. And the second page is, what did it do to make me feel that way? And then the last however many pages I devote to, what is the most cinematic way to express those feelings? And sometimes it ends up being very close to the source material because of that. And sometimes it just sort of captures the spirit of the source material. But as long as I feel like I'm true to the way that the story made me feel, that's a more emotionally honest adaptation.
Sir?
I have such a less concise way of describing. I am currently in development on a couple of other adaptations of other things. But I would say Dick is definitely the first one I tackled. And the way that I was attached to it was reading the material for a different project and then looking at having the experience of reading that, understanding, now that you've said it so concisely, you know, how it made me feel, which was I hadn't encountered a piece of writing that was so propulsive and so strange, and in fact, something that I couldn't see as a television show or a movie. Like, I had no perception of how that could be, and because of what it was exploring was something I had never seen on television, that's where I was like, I must be able to try this and fail big. And so in some ways it was like the draw of the material and less the ability to see it.
So I'll approach it from a slightly different angle. I think creativity isn't just one muscle. It's an entire limbic system. And I think, you know, part of being a writer and working creatively is knowing yourself and knowing kind of what your strengths are and knowing what muscles of yours are the strongest. And I think there's some guys who are amazing, and women, men and women, who are incredible generators. And they have that muscle, you know, that whatever that thing is, you know, Ted Chiang, I don't know where he gets his ideas from. And then there's other writers who are more about execution and on the page. And whenever you're making a movie, whether it be an adaptation or an original or anything else, you're kind of making a case with the universe, right? And it's like, you're looking at that blank page and it's like, and you want, you know, whether it be a cup of coffee or a donut or a theme or a character you love or a drawing, like, you want as much support in that trench as you can get. And so, like, when I got Nimona, here was this beautiful graphic novel with these amazing themes, this clear vision from this, like, 22-year-old storyteller who just, like, kicked the ass of every other graphic novelist in 2016. And so there was just a reaction I had, like, this is something I want in the trenches with me. This is a story I think I can find my way into.
Do you all, I guess I should ask this first, do you actually boil it down to the essence? I mean, when you're each looking at it, do you do that? Or do each of you just sort of start with what you've got? And, you know, I've heard a variety of things from people about taking highlighters through a book many times, or is it first trying to just feel like that gut reaction and then figuring out what falls away?
I'll just speak specifically about Dick. I mean, because I had a character of Chris Krause, who I Love Dick was the first of three novels that examine her marriage and life and kind of trajectory into becoming a writer. The first thing I did was, like, I just then become totally gluttonous. So I just read every single thing that Chris Krause has written, and I read it multiple times, and then go back to Dick, and just, it was hilarious. In our writing room, we treated it almost like, you know, the King James Bible, where we would just do, like, Bible readings every day just to find more Krausians. Then for me, I just try to get my brain to align to Chris's brain and try to understand all the things that she is talking about, because I knew that she was going to be the center of the show.
It's super helpful on many levels to come at it from a place of reverence for the creator, because then you just feel like you're on the side of justice and you're doing a good thing. And I've had it both ways, where I've been kept at a distance from the creator, usually by the studio, or where they've facilitated a relationship with the creator. We were just talking a little bit about working with Ted, and by hands down, like, these are, you know, fantastic people who, they were the ones, it's theirs. It started out as their world and their characters and their kind of thematic little carving of the universe. And so for I know on Girl Who Drank the Moon, just sitting down with Kelly Barnhill, who is this incredible woman, and she was just telling, we weren't even talking about the book. She was telling me stories about her family and her daughters. And, like, there was just a moment where she was talking about her daughter and the primary relationship of the book just four-dimensionalized for me, and I, like, heard the voice. Like, you know, there's always those moments, like, where, you know, maybe it's when you're highlighting, you know, I'm a huge highlighter too, but you just, like, you hear the character, and it's like, it's such a moment of comfort.
You know, I would say, like, what Sarah talked about just trying to get it into that authorial voice, knowing that you're sort of adopting somebody else, that you want to make sure that you have as much of that in your system as possible, so that when you get in the weeds, and you're bound to get lost, that you kind of, you have some guideposts, you have some sense of, like, well, I know this path has been taken before. And in the case of something like Ted Chiang's story, where there's a lot of science behind it, you can run to research as a way to help guide you back and find some truth in the research that sparks the story idea or a character moment or whatever. Another interesting case that happened recently was I adapted a Josh Malerman novel called Bird Box that I was sent back when it was early galleys, and it was a year away from being published. But it was something that Chris Morgan, a friend of mine at the time, had fallen in love with. And he was trying to tell the studio it was a movie. And I read it like in one night, and I called it like, no, we got to make this. You know, and I got really, really excited about that. And basically to get the job, I wrote the first 10 pages of the script and said, this is what it looks like, and this is where we got to go. And they got me in the room with Josh early on and on the phone, and just had a lovely conversation with him where I just started pitching him like, What's happening with this character? What happens over there? I started writing fan fiction, essentially, like little chapters of like another character that he mentions in passing that helped me to fill out the rest of the world and talk about more of the interesting events that he created. And it led to a really interesting synergy where he asked me if he could take one of the little ideas that I had toyed with and put it into the novel before it got published. And there was a character in the early galleys that I absolutely loved, this old grizzled man named Edgar, that his editors eventually said, you got to get rid of this. And he did. So, but I had already adapted the script with this character in it. And when I'd seen the later draft, I went back to Josh and said, Edgar's staying in the movies.
I will also say that I didn't want to meet Chris Krause, the person, because I knew that I was going to be writing her, a version of her. And so for me, I knew my Catholic upbringing was going to make it really difficult for me to engage with a human and then have to try to adapt her and put her in potentially embarrassing or, you know, just raw situations. I would have been biased and held back in some way.
How much do you want to involve the people who wrote the original source material, should they be alive, obviously, but in your work? You know, how is that a plus or a minus?
I mean, I'll just say the other part of that is, knowing Chris's work as I did, I knew that in her film work, she was very accustomed and comfortable and even a champion of appropriation. So, in a well-done way. So when she granted us, you know, the option on the books and permission to do the television show, she did it with a spirit of don't be reverent. I am excited to see what Soloway and Gubbins come up and Catherine comes up with in terms of how you're envisioning this. And by the way, it's, you know, 2016. I wrote the book in 97. So where does this live now? And she did not want to do kind of a period piece, which essentially it could have been. So from the get-go, her involvement as a collaborator was wonderful.
You are friends almost, right? Aren't you guys friends, you and Ted Chiang?
Yes. I mean, me from 5 years ago would lose his mind at that. But yeah, we've gotten to be very close. But I think one of the responsibilities that the screenwriter has is really to manage that relationship. And by manage it, I mean just like find the most mindful and respectful way into it. For Ted, it was, I just had to be careful with his exposure to the screenwriting process because it's very different from the way he approaches his writing. And I had to come to him at a time when I kind of had my act together. Because if I had sent him a partial draft, I think he would have panicked or he would have gotten very judgmental of me. Rightly so. So it's just a matter of making sure that the time, his currency of time was precious and important. And I chose those moments to engage him, mostly to be kind of the police of like, he's Eric, physics don't work that way, or whatever it was. But then later on, we developed into a sort of a closer, tight-knit relationship so that the thing that I'm working on now, I can call him or email him at the drop of a hat, and he'll get back to me right away with possibly still admonition. But with Josh Malerman, it was a completely different relationship. And it's just about when you have that first contact, you get to figure out, okay, where is this going from here? And I could, in the same week, have a conversation with Ted Chiang and then with Josh. And the first two words between me and Josh are like, dude, dude, all right, dude. And then we would get into the nitty-gritty of it and just revel in the genre that we both love telling stories in.
Does Ted say dude?
Never.
Never.
Ever. Ever.
Mark, because your characters actually, what you adapted with Kubo were characters that were part of somebody else's fairy tale, right?
So. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was incredibly blessed with, and I definitely agree with what you said. Like, you are responsible for managing that writer and that relationship, and I've been blessed in that they've all been really lovely people. There hasn't been a lot of judgment. They've been excited that their material is getting adapted, and definitely, you know, with Shannon, I embraced it. It was actually the first thing I ever did in animation was an original idea that Shannon had, where and it was a smaller studio, and they hired me to adapt it. I didn't know Shannon at that time, and they said, "Hey, will you just sit down with this guy just so he feels good about who we're hiring?" And so I sat down with him, and within 20 minutes, I was like, "This guy is a genius, and he clearly understands this idea. I want this guy in the trenches with me." I felt confident enough in my ability to manage, you know, a collaborator that it didn't, I think maybe there might be a temptation to feel a little insecure, to feel like, no, I need my space, but that's just not my process. I'll take all the help I can get. And so we would sit down probably three times a week, and we would just talk about the story, and I would kind of, you know, and I was in another life, I was an executive, so I actually had a lot of experience kind of with the block building of everything, which was something, he's a visual guy, so it was actually a great combination there. And I just remember the first time I pitched him this idea, and he was kind of like looking at me, and he was scribbling something, and I, of course, as an insecure writer, I'm like, oh my God, he hates this idea. You destroy this relationship. And then he holds up a piece of paper, and there it was in black and white. And it was literally, you know, I guess it was another, if you're like a frog jumping across lily pads, it was another lily pad right there in terms of finishing it.
I do so love the festival. A time to celebrate. You know, it's a shame you never stay past sundown. There's fireworks and singing and dancing and feasting, of course. But the best part of all, do you see those lamps and altars? We use those to speak to the loved ones that left us behind. We listen to their tales and guide their safe return to the blissful Pure Land.
Really? Did you speak to someone?
Yes, I did. My husband. His voice was as clear and loud as the one you use for your stories. In 72 years, he never had a thing to say. Now he's gone. I can't shut him up.
You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Sarah Gubbins, Mark Hames, and Eric Heiserer, who have all recently adapted literary works for the screen. When we left off, the three writers were discussing the challenges they faced in capturing the spirit of the source material. Clips of Arrival, courtesy of Xenolinguistics, LLC. I Love Dick, courtesy of Amazon Studios and Topple Productions. And Kubo and the Two Strings, courtesy of Universal Studios, LLC, and Focus Features.
each of you is really, like, you've taken short stories and made them much bigger stories, you two. And in your case, kind of, I mean, you took it and moved into a whole nother place and created essentially something also around that setting, which was not at all part of the story. So I just think that's really, like, can you talk about how you have to expand the universe of what you're adapting and your comfort zone, and then also, you know, do you get scared about what that's going to do with your relationship with that person?
I have a theory, which is that short stories are actually exactly the right length. Short stories and, like, short novellas are exactly the right length for movies. And if you're doing...
Cosine.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say I just wrote a feature that was based on a premise, you know? So it is. So in some ways, that's like microfiction and taking it and writing an entire feature on that. But I wasn't scared at all. I think part of what I understood that we were trying to accomplish and trying to do, and what was the heartbeat, the creative spark of the project, was to unleash in a television show the impulse of a woman arriving at an artistic voice through really opening up and being honest about what her desires were, and how that inspection and how that embodiment was a messy, debasing, euphoric, glorious process. So in order to do that, that was kind of like the thesis point of, you know, what we arrived at. And so it felt limiting to just have one character embody that when you're given the opportunity to have, you know, 8 episodes. That meant you were able to populate a cast that were able to bring multiple perspectives of race, class, gender into that thesis statement.
Well, and so on the subject of impossible adaptations, you had that too. I thought I had read that story Arrival was, and it kind of was an impossible adaptation. So right. Can, you know, I'd love to hear.
Shows how stubborn I am.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
So I'd love to hear from each of you how you decided to approach that medium with your work and make the decisions that you made to expand it.
You mentioned, you know, IP. And I think the thing about IP is sometimes you don't know it's IP, you know? Like, I remember I was actually, before Transformers was a thing, I was an executive. There were 5 or 6 of us in the room, and Mr. Spielberg came in, had all these toys. He had a box of them. He dumped them on the desk, and he said, "This is a huge movie for us. Figure it out." And we were like, "What is this? This 80s toy, these Transformers?" So, you know, here, you know, considered one of the, you know, biggest IPs ever. We didn't see it that way. And I think when you are saying, "Oh my God, this thing is huge," that's when you have to be careful. You know, when you have something you're dealing with that just has, you know, for you, kind of so much weight and so much density and so many things about it that you love, just finding one thing that you can pitch. In the case of Nimona, the graphic novel, it's never labeled, it's never articulated, but it takes place in this kind of strange realm where you have knights jousting, but there's also cell phones and computers. And so I was looking at it, and animation tends to be very world-driven. So I'm like, this is the medieval future. That's what this is. And like, kind of like the moment I pitched that term to the producer and the moment we started calling it, you know, a story of a knight and a shapeshifter set in the medieval future, somehow it kind of came to life for, and I think for me as the writer too, because it gave me my very clear way in to it. So I think a lot of times it's just the ability to kind of articulate one simple truth about what you have that makes it real to all the people, all the marketing people, and the people who need to buy it, and everyone else who's going to be your collaborator and your teammate.
I think a significant portion of this panel is just going to be me reiterating what Sarah has said at some point. What I was relieved about with Story of Your Life was the fact that so much of it was not a one-to-one transition to film at all. Mm-hmm. And the freedoms that I had there were then to find the cinematic version of that. And I wasn't just sort of a court stenographer for Ted. So in so doing, what really made it sing for me was finding a theme that really didn't exist in the story, but that I know that I can write best when I'm really passionate about something or I'm really angry about something. And I can't ever attack it head on. Like, I'm not gonna write an essay and then hope that maybe like BuzzFeed will pick it up or something like that. And I had been seeing, even back in 2013 and 2014, that we have so many amazing communication tools globally right now. Like, we are so interconnected as a people on a global scale, and we are so bad at communicating. We are horrible at it. And that made me so angry, and I realized this is one of the key themes that I had to latch onto for Arrival that Ted didn't need to bother with, because he was so fascinated by other aspects, and I wanted to make sure that I could represent those. But to make it a movie that had all this conflict, it was about the fact that here's a time when we desperately need to talk to each other, and we're immediately suspicious of one another.
Okay, you gave me an assignment, so I'm trying to be very specific with an example. It's very important to me as a writer, and especially as somebody who has been given an opportunity to write and create, it's fair to say, underrepresented perspectives in mass media, like a gender non-binary individuals and people that come from maybe not your what has been populated. So it's always important to me. It was definitely important to Soloway that we were going to do that. That was just understood in our partnership. But there was something about the book and the way that Chris had this past that was seeped in the art world and was seeped in experimental filmmaking that she had to, that part of her journey into obsession was about coming to terms with her own failure as an artist so that she could breakthrough and actually find herself as a writer. And the confrontation of failure, which is a horrible thing for anyone to have to go through, but really difficult when you're in your 40s and have tried your whole life to do something and now you just have to face it in order to grow. So the example is that it wasn't until we were in post that we started interspersing all of these experimental feminist films throughout the series, because we knew that we needed a language that was going to allow us to kind of enrich this character's perspective. And if the show was all kind of Chris's creation of the book, then we wanted that presence and we couldn't burden dialogue with it. And so there's ways in which we found to bring those elements in, we have like these red cards with voiceover that kind of stop the action, because we also wanted to allow the viewer to start to feel what it might feel like for a woman to be driving the narrative and what it meant for her to become the protagonist of this story and really control the outcome. So we allowed her to stop scenes and declare ideas and pivot the action quite literally. But it all grew out of how do we adapt this aspect? You know, it's not enough just to portray. If you pop your adaptation ideas, and that's at the beginning when you're pitching it, you know, sometimes people bring you stuff, but they're bringing you stuff without an outline or without necessarily, they haven't, so what I'm trying to say is, like, we're the seers, like, they're the feelers and the ideas, but we're the seers, like, in a Greek sense of S-E-E-R, you know, like, we are the prophets that are going to be like, yes, this is a movie, this is a television show, because I see it. And so once you're engaged in that way, you know, and you take up that space and you have the confidence to be like, I'm the seer, I'm adapting this, I see this adaptation, and now we talk about what I've told you is the adaptation and how we can make that better and clearer and da 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 da. But it's the transfer that happens between source and adaptation of script, that's your magic. Your imagination is so vivid, and what you've done and what you've promised is what they're buying into.
Can you talk to us about a particular thing that you just felt like, okay, she didn't do this at all, this isn't anywhere in here, but it's something we felt like fit into the message she was giving, and so here's where we're going to really go to town and create a whole episode out of it or whatever.
There is one episode in the show that is formally completely different. It's called A Brief History of Weird Girls. It's written by Annie Baker and Heidi Schreck, two just astonishing playwrights. And it's not a causal kind of episode. It's four women talking about their experiences with their own sexual awakening.
Forgot what lust felt like until I met you. I don't care how you see me. I don't care if you want me. It's better that you don't. It's enough that I want you. Sometimes when I walk down the street, I look into the faces of every woman I pass and I wonder what she sees. I wonder about the history of her desire. Dear Dick, what if we all started writing your letters?
It's very different, and it all came out of, so one of the characters is Chris Krause, and three are invented characters. So all of those characters, you know, is something that's additional to that. But to your larger point, too, so we knew that that was important just in terms of the theme of the show and what we were trying to say, and it was also because it reflected something that Chris was going through very pointedly at that point in the season, was like a breaking past something. But in the book, there's Dick is really, we never hear his voice except through the way that he's present in letters from Chris and Silvera, these other two other characters. So we don't really know who he is. He's in many ways just a projection. You know, we're trying to, who is Dick? Where is Dick? You know, where you're just trying to figure him out. Well, when you cast Kevin Bacon, you're going to have to find who Dick is, because Kevin's going to show up on set and he's going to want to act, and he should, because he's a character and we want him to act. And, you know, so unless he was going to just be kind of a guest on the show every once in a while, a projection of Chris's fantasies, and, you know, drape himself in blankets and ride horses bare-chested, or drape lambs on his shoulders, which are all lovely images, like, you really have to get with who this guy is. And so that was a whole thing that we had to invent. And modeling him in the guy who kind of invented the art version of the town of Marfa is this guy Donald Judd. And, oh, I don't know, our character's name is Dick Jarrett. And so we were, again, adapting some idea, but also, the guy in the book, he's a literary theorist, and that just doesn't seem like it translates well to television necessarily. So we made him an artist, you know. So there's like those kinds of decisions that you make. And then when you're building the plot, you have to understand that at a certain point, people are going to get, you know, after about an episode and a half, they're going to want to be like, what is happening now? So you really have to be mindful about what your viewer is doing and what their experience is as they're binging it on their iPad.
And what did you do within the news story that you're writing? I mean, can you talk about something that you invented out of whole cloth in there, each of you, that added to it but was well within the original intent?
Well, it was the recognizing that every other foreign country was going to be working to bridge that communication gap with the heptapods, and sort of it was a race to be first, to be best friends with our new neighbors. And then the fun that I had was picking a variety of communication styles. And some of that stuff we shot that you don't really get to see a lot of, like at the Hokkaido site, they brought in three cellists and they just played music to see if that would establish an interesting rapport. And, you know, it becomes a very specific plot point that the Chinese side decides to use a mahjong, because trying to teach them the you know, thousands of characters of the Chinese language wouldn't be, they'd be there for a long time. and there are, you know, a few others that I had at the Peruvian site. They brought in someone who was fluent in sign language. All of those are great elements at showing that, despite the fact that we're so terrible at it, a lot of us are still trying desperately to make a connection with one another. And that the moment that authorities feel threatened, then one of the first fatalities in a conflict tends to be communication.
Everything into an ear, I have to explain to a room full of men whose first and last question is, how can this be used against us?
Kangaroo.
What is that?
In 1770, Captain James Cook's ship ran aground off the coast of Australia, and he led a party into the country, and they met the Aboriginal people. One of the sailors pointed at the animals that hop around and put their babies in their pouch, and he asked what they were, and the Aborigines said, kangaroo. It wasn't until later that they learned that kangaroo means, I don't understand.
I can sell that for now.
Yeah.
And remember what happened to the Aborigines? A more advanced race nearly wiped them out.
It's a good story.
Thanks. It's not true, but it proves my point.
Yeah, I think on Kubo and the Two Strings, when I heard the fake Japanese fairy tale, I knew it had potential to be incredibly kind of rarefied, and, you know, it felt wonderfully authentic, and there were these amazing monsters, the Otokoro, the giant skeleton, the sisters wearing the no masks. Like, there were all these amazing visuals, but I was concerned that it felt so culturally specific that there wasn't going to be the opportunity to invite in a mass audience. And so there was a challenge there, which was how to keep all that, those wonderful cultural specifics, but find a way in that maybe could open it up a little bit. And what I brought to it was, and Kubo always played a shamisen, and he always brought the origami to life, but the fairy tale didn't really focus on the idea that he was a storyteller, kind of experiencing one of his own stories come to life. And so I think what I very much wanted to do, and what was meaningful to me, because I definitely agree with, you can write from a place of anger, or you can write from a place of passion. What was really meaningful at the time for me was storytelling. I was just starting to make a living from it in terms of being a writer. And in the original draft of Kubo, on his way to tell his first story, he meets all the critics in the village, because they all have questions about his story. They all have some logic issues about, and then the fishmonger who comes to Kubo's defense says, a story doesn't always need logic to make sense, which was kind of me trying to excuse everything else that was going to happen that made no sense, but hopefully felt emotionally authentic. So I definitely think on Kubo, it was this idea of that he was a storyteller, and the way stories connect us and the way they bring us together, which felt like a more universal theme.
Hello, Mother. Father. I know my stories can tend to get a little long, so I'll keep this brief. I am very grateful I've had the chance to meet you both, hear your wisdom, feel your kindness, even eat a meal sitting between you. This was a happy story, but it could still be a whole lot happier. I don't know exactly what the rules are or how this works, but if there were any way to, I still need you. So I could say this has been a happy story, or I could feel it. We could all feel it. And then we could end this story together.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.